Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very glad to be with you for the next 2 hours on this Monday, October 10th. This is Christopher Columbus Day, but you wouldn't know it from looking at the news online. With apologies to my guest, I'm going to rant on this for just a minute or two, because I think it's very strange that suddenly... As I was doing, suddenly to me anyway, I had to do a search this morning to find out any current news about Columbus Day, because there was nothing on the regular, you know, news lists about it. And what I found was something in the Christian Science Monitor, which maybe because they're called themselves Christian that they did it, but they had a very short item titled, "What's Open, What's Closed, What's Happening?" and a short opinion piece questioning whether we should have a Columbus Day. Because, of course, and I quote from the article, to many Native Americans, Columbus symbolizes slavery. Poor Columbus is not a hero to the multiracial society the U.S. has become. The white men from Europe are seen now as invaders, and mean ones at that, to the white-hating colored peoples who now comprise close to half of the U.S. population. And they are invited to be here by whites. I was rather shocked to find such a scarcity of news. New York had a parade, but the Wall Street Journal gave it only a few lines and no picture. A small East Hanover, New Jersey parade got a short story and two pictures on New Jersey Online. Not that many people look at that, I'm sure, that showed it to be sparsely populated, a few people lining the streets. The New York Times ignored it completely, it seems. Now, maybe something more came up later in the day, but that's what I found. Around 10 o'clock this morning, after the parades had already started, or maybe it was 11. So, it looks like the job has been done and Christopher Columbus has been done away with for Americans. Soon the name of the federal holiday, which probably will remain, might change to Melting Pot Day or Welcome Immigrants Day or something of that nature. Well, last week we discussed this when William Fink was on this program. He is William Fink of Christogenia.org, I'm going to plug his site once again because I didn't do a good job of it last week, Christogenia.org. He's very clear about how the original and intended white Christian culture of the USA has been corrupted from within by Jewish intrigue and money. And tonight, therefore, we're going to focus on a good culture, one that worked for its white members, and that is the Third Reich in Germany, often called Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, because it was brought into being by the National Socialist German Workers' Party, NSDAP, headed by Adolf Hitler. While culture includes many things besides the arts and letters, which most of us think of when the word comes up, it is the total range of activities, ideas, and traditions shared by and cultivated by members of a group. And tonight we're going to look specifically, though, at filmmaking in the Third Reich. For this, we have Rodney Martin on board. Rodney is an expert and connoisseur of Third Reich films, and he's going to tell us about this particular aspect of the culture of National Socialist Germany and also his film and cultural festivals. Welcome back to the Heretics Hour, Rodney.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. Boy, I'm appreciative of your rant because I couldn't find anything out on the left coast in California to the Columbus Day either. So I join you on with your rant. I think it's just another one of those situations where European Americans have caved in and given something away. I just wonder how many minorities in the federal government practice what they preach with their money where the mouth is and showed up to work today, though.
Oh, well, of course, nobody did because it is a holiday. It is a federal holiday, so all those federal workers get the day off, which is why I say they won't change it. They'll just probably change the name of it, just like they did with President's Day. I think that was Washington's birthday or something like that. Well, now, to the listeners, I welcomed you back, Rodney, because I want to remind them that you have been on twice before, and we had really good shows both times, and they can look back in the archives. It wasn't all that long ago to find your shows from previously. And I'm really excited that tonight we're going to talk about this this Third Reich films, because I want to do some shows now on this idea of culture, the idea of what Jewish culture looks like and is that we have become so accustomed to that we most people think it's our own culture, and what a real white culture has looked like when it existed. And we don't have to go that far back to find the German Third Reich culture. So you start in and tell us, because you're the expert here, however you'd like to start with this.
Well, I'm definitely a connoisseur. I'm sure the Jews in Hollywood consider themselves to be an expert on everything about everything, and they've done a real good job of programming people about about how there was no culture in the Third Reich, and the opposite is true, and how the films were weren't all that good, and actually the opposite is true as well. It's just amazing. A lot of people don't realize that there were almost as many films made in National Socialist Germany from 1933 to 1945 as were made in Hollywood. And I will tell you I think that the films were better. The German films were better in terms of writing, in terms of plot and such. And they weren't political films. They were not films to indoctrinate the populace as many believe. I'll give you a little stat here. I'm going to go out of order. I made several pages of notes to prepare for tonight's broadcast. There were roughly in excess of 5,000 films made from, let's say, January the 30th, 1933, when the National Socialist Party became the government of Germany till the end of the war, 1945. Over 5,000, and I'll give you a basis for that number later on as I go through my notes. Of those 5,000, only 90 were commissioned by the government, 90 out of over 5,000. There were various studios. The UFA studios is obviously the most is the most famous. But let's go back a little bit and let's do a little overview from, the fall of Imperial Germany in 1918 to the creation of the Weimar Republic. And bear in mind, the Weimar Republic was a Judeo-Marxist creation. That's what that was. The so-called Democrats that created the Weimar Republic and proclaimed the Weimar Republic and helped force about the Kaiser's abdication, they were all Jewish Bolsheviks. They were hoping for a new Soviet Republic in Germany when the Kaiser abdicated. The culture was the very first casualty in Germany, and rightfully so. That's a big tool in the Judeo-Bolshevik arsenal. You attack the culture, use the culture to brainwash. It's been very effective in the United States, and I'm going to touch on that a little bit. But in the Weimar years in Germany, it offered the first glimpse, I believe, of what would later become what would happen in America in the 1960s and beyond with cultural decadence. I mean, I really think that if you look at what was going on in Weimar Germany from 1920 through 1933, basically the end of Weimar Germany, 1934, you've seen what would happen in the United States. The attack on culture, anything goes, particularly with what was going on in the cultural realm in Germany during that period. In the Weimar Republic, this all began with film, music, and the arts. Just like the playbook that was employed by the Marxist Judeo champions of political correctness some 30 to 40 years later in the United States. And within the the 1933, January 1933, when Adolf Hitler became chancellor, that upset the apple cart in Germany. And the Marxists had always had a fixation. They wanted to control Germany for a whole lot of strategic reasons, and we can get into that later in another program maybe, but there was a whole lot of reasons why the Bolsheviks and the Marxists wanted to control Germany. But, the arts were key elements for the for National Socialism. Unlike other political philosophies, which were, centered around one or two primary themes or issues, National Socialism held a broad worldview, and that's important, Carolyn, people understand. National Socialism wasn't just based, Hollywood would have you believe that it was just based on race and anti-Semitism, and that is entirely false, entirely false. It's important to understand that anti-Semitism was around prior to National Socialism and prior to World War One, and for the exact same reasons why it was prevalent during the National Socialist regime. The Jews have been doing and playing their playbook, for centuries. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. As I said, National Socialism culture was a key element in its foundation. It offered a broad worldview that encompassed social, economics, arts, and culture. National Socialism, unlike capitalism and communism, believed in building a healthy society from the foundation, and you can't have a healthy society without a healthy culture, and culture is the foundation of any society or any nation. Now, some may disagree with me on this, and that's fine, but I think it's true.
Well, another thing, Rodney, is that, I'll just throw in here that the idea that that Hollywood was so advanced, or that Hollywood was just about entertainment, and the film industry in Germany was about propaganda, and you did already touch on that, but that it was controlling the masses or controlling the people's mind. Well, any government is going to put out its own view of things, its own world view, as you're calling it, and there's nothing wrong with that if you're promoting your own values. We have to look at what the values are. What values were the National Socialists promoting, as opposed to what values is Jewish Hollywood promoting? And the National Socialist values, the only thing that is really objectionable to people today, in light of the kind of teachings indoctrination we've been given, is the antagonism to Jews, or the desire to remove Jews from influence in the nation. That's the only thing. And if you look at that, because the films, as I looked them over today, there are very few war films, very few military or militant films. Okay, well, go ahead then.
We're going to get into that, and that's something that's going to really bear in mind, Carolyn, it's hard work to open your mind, to take a crowbar and open one's mind, and then it's really hard work to get people to accept what they've been taught and indoctrinated in the form of the rabbi box in the living room, to accept and say, whoa, I've been taught it, what I've been trained is absolutely wrong. Getting back, let me fall back a little bit. As far as looking at the film, and let's stick with film just a little bit, as far as indoctrination and say preaching the government line, that's what the radio was primarily for. I mean, the radio, the Germans advanced the concept of having mythic. I have one of the original people's radio sets in my living room. People come and look at that, and they see the eagle on there. That was, was pioneered into the National Socialist government. Everybody had a radio, and you'd see the famous posters, "The Fuhrer Speaks," and that was the outreach. Even in the rural communities and the farm and the outlying areas of Germany, that was what that was for. But film, quite the contrary. If you were to contrast German film during the same period, 1933 to 1945, and Hollywood film, actually the films coming out of Hollywood were far more, took far more of an indoctrination point of view than the German films. Like I said, only 90 films out of over 5,000 made were actually commissioned by the government for a specific, outreach purpose. But, the radio, that was a different, there was a broadcasting arm, and that's what the radio was for. Just like FDR had his fireside chats, which he used regularly to lie to people and to coax them into war and such. And so But getting back to the culture and why culture was such a key and element to the National Socialist program and the worldview, I think this is what really scared both the hyper-capitalists and the communists to death. National Socialism provided a real vehicle for the nation's folk, people, to be part of something larger than themselves, something that capitalism and communism just can't provide, because it just doesn't. It's not in the DNA of hyper-capitalism or communism to bring people together for a common good the way that National Socialism did, to tie the culture, the economy,
that's right,
all the good of nation's folk. And what is the unifying, what is the one unifying element? Race. And Carolyn, you've been hitting on this recently, and it's important. Your race is what, race is what unites a nation. Multicultural nations fall. They fall, you know, they fall left and right because there's no unifier. You cannot have a common culture in a multicultural state. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It fails on the surface. And, you know, one need only look and contrast, you know, Weimar Germany versus National Socialist Germany to even, you know, look at this even further. There was a tremendous cultural revival in National Socialist Germany that was non-existent in Weimar Germany. Under Weimar, arts and theater, like in America then and today, was Jewish-influenced and decadent and essentially quasi then and overtly pornographic. Under National Socialism, there was a revival in the traditional arts and festivals that had long been repressed for all intents and purposes under Weimar. And as you drew the on your rant today, where are the Columbus Day events? When I was a youngster in elementary school, you know, we had Columbus Day events in school. I dare say not a single elementary school in my town that I live in today did anything on Columbus Day.
I'm sure if they don't even make a little story in the newspapers, which was just, it's just something that's done for every holiday. They always have something. They have nothing. I mean, that's pretty shocking. That shows it's totally out of fashion.
Under Weimar, in Weimar Germany, Europe saw the opening of the first gay bars, clubs, and bathhouses, and the first assault on traditional values through Jewish-controlled media as, quote, repression, and under Weimar, church attendance fell. Incidentally, all of these were reversed under the National Socialist government. Church attendance doubled under National Socialist Germany, and, of course, the decadence was quickly stamped out. Finally, you know, one of the shining examples is look at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, the opening ceremonies. And by the way, the Berlin Olympics was originally awarded to Weimar Germany. Of course, there's a change of government in 33. But look at the opening ceremony of the 1936 Berlin Olympics. It's obvious by looking, and actually I have the Leni Riefenstahl Olympia film of the Berlin Olympics. It is obvious by looking not only at the opening ceremony, but looking at the crowds, looking at the influence of the opening ceremonies on the of the participants, how they all raised their arm in the German salute.
Yes.
With the exception of two or three nations. Only three nations did not do that out of the 90 that were there. That Germany had experienced a tremendous cultural rebirth just in 36 months. Bear in mind that the Berlin Olympics took place a little less than 36 months from the time of the National Socialist became the governing body of the nation. Another great example would be a film. There's film clips available of the 1935 Buchenwald Thanksgiving Festival, where you see Germans from all the different states and cultures within Germany in their traditional attire, all united into this traditional celebration. You see the reemergence in the 30s of the traditional ceremonies, the traditional festivals and such that had been non-existent for the 20 to 20 years of the Weimar.
The revival of folkism, or, you know, what you might call the folkish activities and so on that were so very wholesome, and singing songs, and they sought to find these old songs from the different areas of Germany that the people had, and they were doing all of this kind of work Yeah, and a lot of young people were involved in this. In fact, this was a lot of the work of the Hitler youth and the Hitler girls that were involved in bringing this to the people.
If you look at these films and you look at these festivals and you look at some of the events prior, what the one thing that multiculturalists do and the Judeo-media does is they divide people. They pit the young against the old, and yet a focused community brings the young and the old together. The young can learn from the old, and the young helps the old. I mean, you bring everybody together. They talk about we want unity. You hear this from the left and the leftist number. We want unity and unity. But that's not the practical application of what they do. They play young against old. Work. They don't. The true focused community under the National Socialist government actually brought everybody into a true classless society for the betterment of the people. And bear in mind, people meant something in that. Let's talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions about film in the Third Reich. Film was not a state industry like it was in the Soviet Union, or a Jewish conglomerate like it is in the United States and has been since probably the 1920s. Bear in mind that during this time, film in the United States in the 20s and 30s was still split between Hollywood and New York, obviously. There was advisory bodies created in July of 1933 called the Reich Chamber of Film, but there were chambers for essentially, these chambers were essentially advisory groups. There was chambers for music, chambers for film, chambers for literature, chambers for broadcasting, art, etc. Each chamber had its own president. Usually there were about seven members of these chambers or advisory boards. They didn't necessarily consist of Nazi Party members. For instance, Richard Strauss was the president of the Chamber of Music, and while Goebbels was president of the film chamber because he had a keen interest in film, the vice president was an UFA studio executive and a non-NSDAP member. And for the most part, the chambers were drawn from the respective industries in finance, law, and in academia. Lots of PhDs. There's a big misconception, let me pause here, Harold, that the Nazi Party was made up of thugs and bullies and criminals and such. Interestingly, a vast majority, I think about 90%, 80%, and I might be a little off on this, of the leadership of the SS held PhDs and law degrees, just using that as an example. About 90% of the policymakers, those that drafted proposed policies that went on to be approved by Adolf Hitler in the upper echelon, were people with PhDs, doctorates. Mm-hmm. And I dare say that the doctorates that were produced in the universities in Germany then probably had a lot more meat than they do now.
Yes.
In addition, to the chambers in 1934, the Weimar law was abolished, the Weimar cinema law. Was abolished. Interestingly, under the Weimar cinema law, anything went. This was, you know, as I said earlier, Carolyn, under Weimar, you had essentially quasi-pornography.
Why did they have a law? Why did they say they had a cinema law when you say everything went? I mean, anything
went. Under Weimar, they basically said they were going to oppose any form of censorship. And this, interestingly, we talk about the self-loathing in Germany today. That didn't start post-1945. That started in Weimar, under Weimar. You had a lot of film and literature coming out in Weimar talking about how bad it was to be a German, how, you know, remember now, they do this post-World War II, but they were doing this post-World War I. How Germany, you know, it's bad to be a German. We, you know, the evil Hun. We picked World War One. They were doing this post Weimar.
Sure,
they had this Weimar cinema law that basically said anything goes. And like I said, this was essentially reinstated post World War II, with the exception that everything was banned. That was made between 1933 and 1945. All the National Socialist films and literature and art and such that wasn't destroyed during the war. Under the new cinema law, Dr. Ernst Seeger was named head of the film department, and the film department was moved actually from the Interior Ministry, where it had been under Weimar and under Goebbels' ministry in the propaganda. It was charged basically to review films. The new Under the new law, films could be banned based on endangering the public order. And I'm reading this directly from the Act. You're going to find this interesting. Another one of the big lies is that National Socialists were anti-church, anti-Christian. Under the National Socialist Cinema Act, a film could be banned if it harmed religious sensibilities. Now, so much for the National Socialist government being anti-church and anti-Christian.
And so now these restrictions that National Socialism put on, you might say, there's censorship laws or whatever, were for the purpose of cleaning up the terrible filth and mess that had occurred under the Weimar regime. So the purpose was to make Germany, a healthier, more morally upright and cleaner nation once again, and more German.
You're going to find there was only five basic categories, and it was endangering the public order, harming religious sensibilities, brutalizing, depraved, or endangering German prestige or German relations with foreign states. Mm-hmm. Or there was additional clause that specifically protected the institution of marriage. Carolyn will continue after the question.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, the UK has the second largest number of troops deployed in Afghanistan. Anti-war activists, celebrities and politicians are gathering in London protesting over a decade of war. RT's Ivor Bennett is there for us and joins us live. Ivor, there have been protests since the war began over the past 10 years. Is the decade milestone making a difference to the numbers this time round?
That's what they accuse us of.
The decade anniversary certainly is helping to drum up some more anti-war support and support for the anti-war protest movement, certainly. This is the largest anti-war protest that we've seen for a number of years here in London, I'd say, because over the last 2 years, it has dwindled somewhat, just as people in the public has realised that we're in this seemingly endless war, and it's not going to end soon, certainly not in a pretty way. And today, on this anniversary, people have realised, I think, the full cost of the war. It's really sunk in. The US and the UK have collectively spent almost $500 billion on the war. 2,500 foreign troops have died there, and they're stuck in this seemingly unwinnable war. So behind me, the protest here in central London, Trafalgar Square, is in full swing. There's about probably 1,000 to 2,000 protesters gathered in the square behind me. There's speeches going on the stage. The opening one was just recently given by an Afghan war veteran from the British Army who was actually imprisoned for objecting to serve a second stint out there. So that was kicked off earlier today. It's all been organised by the Stop the War Coalition that came into being 10 years ago. And one of the main stalwarts behind that movement has been Lindsay German, who I'm joined by now to talk more about this. Lindsay, thanks very much for speaking to us. So the seemingly likely end to this decade-long war so far looks like the power sharing deal with the Taliban. Not really the victory that was envisaged 10 years ago, is it?
Well, no, of course they claim that this is about democracy, but they are doing a deal with the Taliban. The most likely thing is power sharing. And this is an admission that they are losing the war. The last 2 years have been the worst 2 years in terms of casualties for the war. And it is very, very hard for the British or the Americans to make any advance. They talk about advances, but really these are cosmetic changes. They're not fundamental changes. So we say the war should end, the troops should be withdrawn. And in this country, people are suffering. Cuts, attacks on welfare and education. And yet there is limitless money for war, and we want to change this.
And what has been achieved, if anything, in this last second? I mean, you could argue, couldn't you, that the gulf between the Muslim Arab world and the West is now bigger than it was a decade ago.
10 years ago, I spoke here in Trafalgar Square and I predicted all the things that have happened. And not just me, many, many people predicted these things.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am here with my guest, Rodney Martin, and before we return to our topic, I want to tell you that our call-in number for the second hour, which will start at the top of in 1/2 hour, is 1-855-477-2283. So if you're coming up with questions, write your questions down and call in at that time, and we'll be able to talk to you. And Rodney, I wanted to mention to the listeners that you have a website, which is Worldview Foundations. And this is probably a part of your whole organization that you're putting together, and it can be found at wvfoundations.org. wvfoundations.org, and you have put on one or two film festivals, and you're planning more and some National Socialist or Third Reich, I guess we should say, film and cultural festivals. And we can actually talk about that in the second hour. We will have time to do that. So right now, letting the people know that, and let's continue with when we went to the break, you were talking about the National Socialist German film censorship laws, and that, yeah. And to make sure everybody hears those, you might repeat those.
So let's understand. They use the word censors because anybody that makes films. If I made a film, Carolyn, if you made a film or made a book, and I had to submit it for review for guidelines, we would automatically say, oh, you're going to censor me. So that's where they were guidelines, because this film agency actually, they would also apply ratings to films. But it's important. Let me go back and restate these again. Mm-hmm. The film department would review the films, and they could be banned, or they could be modified, sent back for editing based on endangering the public order, harming religious sensibilities. And again, I think that's interesting, because here you have the National Socialist government protecting the church's interest, and yet they're considered that they always go around saying the opponents of National Socialism, they're anti-Christian and anti-church, brutalizing or depraving or endangering German prestige or Germany's relations with foreign states. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, there was a section 1.2 of the law that specifically protected the institution of marriage in any film. Now, bear in mind, I've indicated that during the Weimar years, there was some of the quasi-pornography and some of anything goes. That also, in addition to some of the first, homosexual promulgation of pro-homosexual media, that was beginning to creep into the culture as well. So here you have National Socialism being the first government that actually took a pro-marriage public policy position and codified it into law. I found that really interesting. Now,
well, I do too. And also, tell us what is meant by endangering. What was that first one? Endangering the public. Peace or something, because that sounds strangely like the kind of laws they have in Germany today when you talk about anything anti-Semitic or anti-Holocaust, but it probably was not. So what was that?
I could not find a film that had been banned or edited based on that provision. Okay. So I can't give you an example. Anything I would say here would be speculative, and I would probably agree with your statement. But I can tell you this: we know, as I said earlier, there was well in excess of 5,000, probably 8,000 to 9,000, 10,000 films made. And a lot of people say, oh, see, they were censoring. Well, from 1934 to 1945, only 27 films were actually censored, and 81 that were sent back for edits, and then were edited and released into the German cinemas. And
okay.
When I say cinema, people should understand that cinema is a movie theater. I use that word every once in a while from younger folks, and they look at me strangely. It used to be when you used to dress up for a night out, you'd go to the cinema. But now that's become the theater or the walk-in. And again, bear in mind, worldwide, only Hollywood in New York, again, the American, United States motion picture industry was split between Hollywood and New York. Only Hollywood, only United States produced more films than Germany. So, again, you had these standards, these, quote, censorship standards. And also, bear in mind, the United States had, had quote, censorship standards equally, almost on the same footing as National Socialist Germany as well. They had very similar quote unquote standards as well.
Yes, at one time the United States had pretty good film standards,
yeah.
Standards of all kind, but they have slowly been eroded.
Yeah. Let's see. And again, I mentioned this earlier. Between 1933 and 1940, only 96 films were commissioned officially by the German government between 33 and 45. So again, the film industry, while it was, it did have to go through, it had review, it had standards, it was not a, per se, a tool of the state as much as it would have been in the Soviet Union where every, where it was actually a state institution.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is going to be interesting. Just prior to the National Socialist government coming to power in 33, the German film industry was in dire financial straits. Ticket sales all over Germany, and bear in mind, Germany was significantly larger then than it is now. You know, it's missing three major provinces since 1945. Ticket sales were down, and the number of cinemas in 19, the number of theaters, I'll say theaters, there were over about 5,100 theaters in Germany in 1929. 1932, there was...
Well, they were called cinemas because theater, there was a lot of theater in Germany. And
yes,
theaters were for live performances other things
right.
like that. And so I think you should just go ahead and call it cinema so that if we get into this a broader cultural discussion later on or another program, we won't...
Right. The cinema is where you went and looked at the thing on reels, is what I tell the younger folks. Theater is where you go and watch live performances of Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
But by 1936, bear in mind, by 32, that the cinema was in real bad shape, even though under Weimar, anything went. They can produce anything they want. And again, you can see, I read into that the German public secretly was rejecting that. They were looking for this cultural renewal. They were rejecting the decadence. But in any event, by 1936, less than 36 months later, this had all significantly turned around. They were backed up to around, I think, 5,500 cinemas. And, of course, you had an explosion of film production. You had new studios opening up. You had UFA with a resurgent UFA. You had Dias. You had Carl. I mean, I'm just naming some of the major studios that were in operation in the Third Reich. One of the films, let me just talk about in just a few minutes some of the films. These weren't all overtly nationalistic films. There was a film, and I actually have a copy of this one, made in 1936 in Germany called, you know, The King of California, The Kaiser of California, which they actually did a film on John Sutter, you know, his exploits in California. Very good film. Very good. The writing, the film, you know, the what we call, of course, you know, people think special effects, they think Star Wars and stuff now, but if you look at what was available at the time, the German production was second to none. I'm going through my notes, but there was the production was absolutely superb, and it made Hollywood take notice. Now let's it's important to note too what's in the films and what's not in the films, as opposed to, and I'm going to compare these to Hollywood and New York of the same period of time. Very little about it. If you look at all of the films, and of course when you talk about German films, the first thing people talk about is The Eternal Jew or The Triumph of the Will or those that Hollywood likes to prop up, when those were clearly political films. And mm-hmm. frankly, I don't have a problem with those either. Very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Triumph of the Will, was widely received by the international film community at the time.
Well, sure, because a point that might be made is that up until 38, 39, the rest of the world was not having much of a problem with Hitler and the National Socialist regime. And so, like, when you mentioned at the Olympics, when all these other countries, out of respect for Germany, raised their hand in the, what's called the Nazi salute, the straight arm salute, that nobody thought anything so bad about that. It was only a few, like you said, that didn't. But later on, of course, you know, it becomes a crime to do so. So this is just
That straight arm salute, children in the United States schools use that same salute, the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag, up until 1941, or 1942, actually, when it was actually changed by Act of Congress. Oh. People don't remember that either.
I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
I can send you pictures and articles, but that there are pictures. The kids, the United States public schools, used the straight arm salute to salute the flag, and it was an act of Congress. Congress passed a resolution in 1942 to change it.
Wow, that's perfect. That's just perfect.
Yeah. And but anyway, that there's very little violence. It's contrast. I mean, and there were so many films on different. You know, there was love stories. There was detective dramas. I mean, there was just so many. There were quasi musicals. And by the way, the music quality, the music was outstanding. I just ordered and got a set of just the soundtracks from the movies from the 1934 to 1940, from some of the select movies as well. But some of the movie, the soundtracks alone, the musical selections in these was just were works of art themselves, let alone, you know, the writing and the plot in the movies themselves. But when you look at, you know, you hear that, the hatchet job that the media does on National Socialist Germany about, oh, they were infatuated with violence and all that. Well, a nation's culture is a reflection of their social norms. So if they were so infatuated with violence, well, then obviously their film, their art and such would reflect that. Neither their film nor their art or their literature reflects all of this mean and violence. Quite the contrary. Look at American film today. You can't even get anybody, you can't even get the movie to make any money unless there is blood and gore and murder and sex and perversion. All of that is absolutely absent in the National Socialist films of the time. It's absolutely absent. You just don't see it in those films. They're very well, you have to be a thinker. And anybody that wants to watch these films, first of all, you have to be either a German speaker, or you can get some of them with subtitles, which means you have to watch it and read the subtitles. And sometimes the translations are off a little bit, but they're close enough to enjoy the film and understand, you know, and understand it. But bear in mind, I believe that the intellectual ability of the people at that time and of the movie going or the cinema going public was far greater than it is now. So the cinema goer now would be bored by these films. I'm not, and in fact, I incorporated some of them into class projects, you know, for my children in their homeschooling, and then some of these films have tackled social issues. Here you have there's a 1940 there was I Accuse, in which euthanasia was addressed. And it was addressed very thoughtfully. The main character was a female who was married to a doctor, and she was dying of multiple sclerosis, and she demanded, she wanted to end her life. It was illegal. The plot of the movie, of the German film, has it being illegal at the time. A doctor helped. There's a trial before a German court, and they go through the whole debate, the legal and moral debate in this film on euthanasia. Now, this film was produced in 1940, and Carolyn, it is the exact same debate that Oregon had when they debated their euthanasia. The arguments are the same. The legal logic is the same, and yet Germany encapsulated this argument and this moral debate in a film 65 years before Oregon did it.
Well, there you go. We do know that Germany has been a forerunner and been ahead of the rest of the world in so many areas. And this is just another one. I noticed when I was going through the films of all those years that there was a couple of films, two or three. One was I Accuse. So that's not eugenics. That's euthanasia. There's a couple on eugenics, I think, that they brought that before the public.
Yeah. Now, see, there's another example. There it is. All the stuff was being done behind closed doors. Yet people were being deceived. Mm-hmm. National Socialist Germany was an incredibly open society. Yes. They addressed critical and thought-provoking issues in the public debate. You know, they had regular broadcasts, and they discussed these issues. But then they took it out into the cinema, as well. And these films, you know, bear this out. And I want to touch on something. There are a lot of people that have, I would say, fixations with the Third Reich, and people that think they know how it was. And they would be greatly disappointed to actually, if they were to get it into a time machine and find themselves back into the Third Reich. Because one of the film festivals, you know, that I helped put on, a couple of younger people showed up, and they were greatly exacerbated to learn how things were actually were in the Third Reich, it wasn't run and gun, it wasn't Hollywood, it wasn't just a bunch of Wehrmacht soldiers going around shooting everybody and stuff. It was very much an intellectual based and a very thought provoked and engaged society. And mm-hmm. So there are those that, if you really want to know what life was like, then watch these films. Look at the level of detail. In a lot of cases, you would find in some of the films, Kohlberg, for example, is one, and Staff Troop 1917, those films were actually commissioned by the German government. You actually see Wehrmacht troops. They were actually played extras in that. You actually see bits and pieces of everyday life in Germany played out, not only in those two films, but in all the films. You'll see how people acted, not the actors acting, but you'll see the mannerisms, you'll see the etiquette and such. And it's really an enlightening experience to see somebody that thinks or base their knowledge on everyday life in the Third Reich based on books by authors that have secret motives, and you and I know what that means, and Hollywood and documentaries that have hidden agendas, as opposed to the real witnesses. And let me tell you, there's, you know, the real witnesses are getting to be very elderly. We talked about that on a prior show. The only, you know, the very few resources we have left to really educate people, Carolyn, on what life is really like are these films and the legacies that have been left behind that the opponents can't go after. And they are making a concerted effort to go after those, and I'll touch on that as well. Folks have asked, you know, what happened to all of the films? Because of the 5, 6, 7, 8,000 that were made, there's only a few hundred that you can actually get. Well, hundreds were outright destroyed in the very last probably 18 months of the war due to the ground war, the advancement of the Soviet and the Western Allied armies, and then bombing. There were probably about 500 destroyed in the Hanover bombing alone. There are 1,500 destroyed in the bombing of March of 1945. And then there was a convoy in March of 45. You know, the studios, the Germans were trying to protect their cultural assets as the war was being lost. They were trucking, they were putting artifacts, art, cultural artifacts into salt mines and underground and such. Well, you know, the studios were putting their film cells. They were trying to move those too. But in one case, a convoy carrying 2,000 films was hit by bombing and was destroyed as well. And then, of course, the biggest travesty, when the Soviets just pillaged and destroyed the UFA, the largest studios outside of Babelsberg as well. But there was an interesting report that came out in late 1952. And I said earlier that in one, you know, Hollywood and American film talked out of both sides of their mouth, discount the German films and said they were nothing but a hate propaganda and not worth looking and nobody should look at them. And to make sure about that, the Wiesenthal Center will say they should be banned. But they weren't on the same par quality-wise as American film. But in late 1952, the United States Attorney General had issued a report that indicated that they had in their possession over 4,000 German motion pictures that they had taken possession of after the war and were holding as they were holding the copyrights to and the intellectual property rights to. And then, of course, today the quote-unquote German government will send official notices and legal notices to anybody that operates a website. I suppose I'll get one when I put some films up there too that basically shows these films or music or artwork, puts up a reproduction of some of the artwork, even though the copyrights have all long expired. If you show these films, show the artwork, play the music, you'll get a letter from the German government saying you're violating their law and you're violating their self-loathing laws, what I call it, and and that you have to take those off your website and destroy them, or you're going to face a prison in a German prison and re-education. So that kind of gives you an understanding of what happened to the films, kind of a summary of the films, and what the why there's so few today, and there is a concerted effort by the occupied government in Berlin to repress. They don't even want you to look at a film. They don't want you to, whistle a tune. They don't want you to look at some of the reproduction of some of the paintings and the artwork that used to be housed in the House of German Art in Munich. And that's been, I think, tells a lot. If we can get the culture out and expose people to the culture and thus correct the record that way, I think it will go a long ways in opening people's eyes to what life was really like. Because, the old lies that have been being told now for the last 40 or 50 years, it's just not working for them anymore. People are beginning to, say, well, we've heard that, that record just is getting a little old.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's like the whole globalist world is against us learning anything about this period and about Germany during this period, and also looking at the films or seeing anything that's not under their control. So they behave, as everyone is starting to see, exactly like what they accuse the Hitler regime as being. As you say, the Hitler regime was very open, not only with their own people, and they did, talk and share and bring things forth, and the things were not done in secret. But Hitler was even open with the whole world. He said what he was going to do, and, he wasn't doing all that secretive stuff that they do. So the whole thing is just so turned around. Well, what else about the films?
Well, interesting. I think, we've gone a long way this, this first half of the show. The misnomer, the false statements that, the films couldn't be made because the SS, the men in the black uniforms were there regulating and watching everything. Well, that wasn't true either. Films were made. They were submitted through a regulatory process. And there was only a handful, 27, were ever actually rejected out of hand, out of, at least 6,000 to 7,000 that were actually produced and put on the market. I mean, this was a free market for all intents and purposes, as long as they met the minimum standards that were essentially very similar to the standards that were in the United States. And interestingly, a little side note, the SS wasn't big enough to be hanging around at film studios, and because there was many film studios. The Stasi, by comparison of the East German communist regime, East Germany was only a fraction of the size of National Socialist Germany, was four times bigger than the Gestapo, and nobody talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
And had, four times as more agents. And so it's not it's just rather interesting. And again, getting back, we hear about you know, they were not all propaganda films. You know, bloody,
well, that's what
bloody
I was going to say. They're entertainment. I mean, the vast majority of the films made were to entertain the public.
Yes, right? And like I said, and these actresses and actors went on. They went on to have careers after. I mean, they had a hard time because they were harassed and such. But these are actors and actresses were outstanding performers. They were outstanding. And Elsie Lerner is the one. She was. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head of some of the ones. I'm looking at some of the films that I have stacked up in front of me right now.
Well, look at here. We've already come to the end of the first hour. So we will continue with this when we come back after the top of the hour news break. And at that time, we'll take calls at 855-4...
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From FSN, I'm Ollie Barrett with the latest world news. Egypt's military rulers have called for an urgent investigation into unrest in Cairo involving Coptic Christians and security forces on Sunday. Security forces moved in as clashes erupted at a march organised by Copts angry at an attack on a church, but eyewitnesses say troops opened fire on the crowds and television footage showed military vehicles running people over. Libya's interim government forces say they have pro-Gaddafi troops cornered in two small areas of Sirte. One commander has told the Reuters news agency they've backed the loyalists into around 2 square kilometres of land near the sea. The Franco-Belgian bank Dexia is being restructured and its Belgian arm nationalised. It's become the first major banking casualty of the Eurozone debt crisis because of its high exposure to Greek and Italian debt. Our Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mock reports.
The breakup of Dexia was agreed after marathon negotiations between France, Belgium and Luxembourg. The Belgian government says it will now pay €4 billion for the Belgian arm of Dexia as part of the bank's restructuring. Dexia is the first large European bank to need a state bailout since the financial crisis of 2008. It came about after other banks grew increasingly reluctant to lend to Dexia because of its exposure to highly indebted Eurozone states like Greece and Italy. The governments of Belgium, France and Luxembourg will now also provide an additional €90 billion in funding guarantees for the bank for up to a decade. On Sunday, the leaders of France and Germany said they were putting together a plan to recapitalize Europe's banks, some of which are now looking extremely vulnerable owing to the sovereign debt crisis.
Two American academics have been jointly awarded the 2011 Nobel Prize for Economics.
Professor Thomas J. Sargent at New York University, New York, USA, and Professor Christopher A. Sims at Princeton University.
Thomas Sargent and Christopher Sims were recognised by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences for research on cause and effect in the macroeconomy. Professor Sims admits it took two attempts to get hold of him to tell him the news.
I was sleeping, and actually the first we were called twice, and my wife couldn't find the talk button on the phone, so we went back to sleep.
The former leader of the African island nation, Cap Verde, President Pedro Verona Perez, has won this year's $5 million Mo Ibrahim Prize for Good Governance in Africa. The prize is awarded each year to a democratically elected leader, but there's been no winner for the past 2 years because the prize committee decided there had been no credible candidate. For more on what our reporters are covering worldwide, including video and audio reports and details of where to find them on Twitter, visit our blog, fsnreportersblog.com. This is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour of the Heretics Hour. We haven't changed the name of this program to the Heretics Hours or anything, so we just hope people realize that even though it's called the Heretics Hour, we are now 2 hours. And this is our call-in hour, and I'll repeat the number, 1-855-477-2283. Now, my guest tonight is Rodney Martin, and we're talking about films in the Third Reich era. And we were discussing whether to talk about the Jewish people in the film industry and what happened to them. And it really was not that much of a deal. Most of them left early on. But if anybody has any questions about that or wants to ask about it, you can call in and do that. In the meantime, I'm going to ask Rodney a question from and Rodney's website, I want to tell you, is wvfoundations.org. wvfoundations.org stands for worldviewfoundations.org. Rodney, someone wrote to me after I sent out the announcement for tonight's program asking about a film, and he said he wouldn't be able to listen live because he's not in the United States. But he would greatly like to find out if you know a film, The Warschauer Zitadelle, which Germany produced in 1937. It is based on a Polish play of the same name, which deals with one of the many Polish uprisings against the Russians. And it was shot on location in Warsaw, but is now blacklisted, he said. By whom, I'm not sure. Is it possible to obtain a copy of that film on DVD, for example? So do you have an answer for this? This is from Thomas.
Yep. Yes, that film was produced in 1937, and that fell under the category, one of the four categories, about films having to, Germany was very sensitive about films not running awry of their relations with foreign countries. And as you've talked about on prior shows, Carolyn, the Germans tried to make nice with the Poles for a long time. And, you know, and the Poles were being very duplicitous. They were playing on the, you know, they were playing footsies of the British, they were playing footsies of the Germans, they were playing footsies. And, you know, prior to, you know, late 38, 39, the Germans actually, there was some semi-good relations with the Poles. And this particular film was made actually to keep a Polish-German alliance per se. And so it was very sympathetic to the Polish anti-Russian feelings that were very prevalent in Poland. It's a very good film. I mean, it's not one of my favorites because I have positions on the Polish question that you're very that you're aware of. You know, they're sitting on three German provinces that I think should be returned, that they don't belong to them. But anyway, it is a very good film. The writing is excellent. It's a drama. It's a drama film. It's a family.
I think it translates the Warsaw Citadel, right?
Yeah. Right. And so anyway, the current answer is, if you have that gentleman email me and I'd be happy to send him a copy. I do have that film in my collection and it has English subtitles.
Well, that would be so kind of you. You're going to have everybody writing you for copies of films. What is your, do you mind giving your email address?
Yeah, it's director@wvfoundations.org.
Oh, okay.
And let me talk really quickly about my website. It's going to be some significant changes and announcements and stuff on it. I haven't had it updated in a while because I've been having some health issues that I've been tending to. So I've been tending to that and just basically doing some, longhand writing stuff, getting stuff ready to go on the site. But the site is going to be much more interactive and have some more cultural content and some film and art content on it here in the near future. But if somebody has a request or something, they can reach me through the website, and there is a link on the website as well. So if they just want to go to the website, they can reach me there.
Very good. Very good. Are there more things about the films that you would like to say?
Well, I think the films are a direct link to, and I sound like a broken record, but I think it's important for anyone that wants to know what life is really like. They need to watch these films and not watch the ones that you hear most about. Again, you know, the ones you hear most about are the eternal, the propaganda, the political film. There's nothing wrong with those. But,
no.
You know, there are...
They're popular.
Right. There are hundreds.
And they're available. Yes. Well, where would they get them? I mean, how would we see these films without going to some certain place and maybe buying them?
Well, I tell you what I'm planning to do, and I'm going to make an announcement here on your show. I'm planning to put on basically, call it a Third Reich cultural night, on some venues around, and it'll start off basically in the western part of the United States. But my goal is to have an evening, and it's something where it's, you know, it would take a serious minded, you know, person to attend, because what I want to do is to have a display. What the program would be to display some replicas of some of the artwork that was produced during the 33-45 period. And that would give a window into the, what was, some of the cultural, revivals that took place, during, Germany during the 1933 and 45 period, as well as show, some of them, a movie or two, and show a video of one of the symphonies. I've recently been able to acquire a video of four different videos of some of the original symphonies that were performed during the Third Reich period from 1936 to 1943. And those were outstanding. And if people would just, you know, see a symphony, mm-hmm. That was performed, mm-hmm. by the Berlin Philharmonic during, you know, 1939, 1938, 1940. I also, I mean, bear in mind, let's go back to the culture real quick.
Yeah,
culture was so important. Culture was so important in National Socialist Germany that the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra performed symphonies in factories for factory workers.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of that's a special thing that that they did to bring everything that they could to the working people to show that they were respected, they were important. They wanted to destroy this this class consciousness among Germans, so that you had one German group disliking another German group, looking down on it or resenting it or this or that. And so that they would see themselves as Germans working together without destroying classes as such.
Right.
You know, not wanting to destroy the classes, that there were working people, there were the owners and there were the non-owners, you know, and that was all as accepted as the way things are in the natural order of things. But they didn't want mm-hmm. one to be taking advantage of the other. On either
Absolutely.
Side. That's why the labor unions were disallowed because they were communists, and that's what their idea was. And instead, they had a kind of a national labor board, which forced mm-hmm. the business owners to come together with the working people and their representatives and come out with a solution that was acceptable to both. And they had some people there, you know, overseeing it. But, you know, they had to do it, and they went along with it. The business industrialists went along with it because they knew that the alternative was going to be communism. They did not want communism. That's why they went along with Adolf Hitler and his National Socialism, right? It was better. And another thing about the culture is that they had programs, and this was something that Hitler really pushed himself. To take the symphonies and so on, let's just say the symphonies, but also opera companies and so on, from the big cities the opera companies couldn't go to these small towns. They didn't have facilities. But art exhibits and mm-hmm. symphony orchestras to even small towns and villages on these traveling things they did to bring this culture to all the people, and high culture was really a part of National Socialist Germany. Well, it had been a part of Germany, but they wanted to bring it to all the people, not just to the elite people at the top.
Absolutely.
Hello, Miss Yeager.
Hello, somebody's on. I didn't get
well,
the message.
Well, I'm a caller from San Francisco.
Well, hello, thank you.
I don't have a question, more a statement, a personal statement, underwriting and confirming the remarks and the commentary of your guest. I was stationed in Berlin between November 40 and April 1942 and had a chance to participate, see, and be invited to all different cultural events, primarily theater, symphonies, musicals, and also attending movies. And the statements of your guest are correct and 100% proven. I was surprised about the tremendous variety of the cultural events in Berlin. And mind you, that was 1.5 years after the start of the war. I mean, the Opera House, States Opera House, the German Opera House was open, the Admiralspalast and Metropole, the Philharmonic and the Symphony, just a tremendous amount of variety in the cultural life. And as far as the movies were concerned, leading actors of the German Reich were also participating in those movies, like Heinrich George and Jannings and Krauss and Fröhlich and Willy Bürgel. All the leading men and ladies were participating at the UFA company producing all those films. And I was very much impressed by the remarks of your guest, and I totally agree what he is telling your answers.
Well, I'm so glad that you're happy with what he said. And you are Wilhelm, right, from San Francisco?
Yeah.
And we're very happy to have you call in today. Do you have any other remarks you want to make about your what you know about, since you were living there then? Your feelings about the change from the Weimar regimes to National Socialism?
Well, I was not exposed to any Weimar movies in my youth time, but the movies which I attended during these years in Berlin and before that were a large variety of different topics, historical, documentary, comedies. Well, I remember that some of the classic novels of Schiller and Goethe, Kleist, were made movies. And Leni Riefenstahl, for instance, he mentioned the movies of the Olympic Games. Well, she was considered as really the innovator of documentaries, and I think even acknowledged by the New York organization of documentaries. And well, those were the Olympic film and the film of the Reichsparteitag in Nürnberg, Triumph of the Will, were naturally government sponsored. But beside that, she did private movies like the SOS Iceberg and some other movies. I mean, that's, again, a large, large variety and a very vivid cultural life in Berlin at that time. I mean, in operas and symphonies.
You never had any feeling that you were lacking freedom during those years, did you?
No. No, no, not at all. I mean, I was stationed at two different airfields in Berlin, and whenever I didn't engage in my duties, I had access to excellent tickets and enjoyed. I mean, there was I could do what I wanted to do within my duties. I mean, liberty, freedom,
complete. In your free time. All right. Well, thank you so much for this call, Will.
Okay. Well, enjoy the show and good luck to you.
Rodney, did you want to ask him a question?
Yes. Well, I think he hung up. But,
yes, he
I'm
did.
Sure
sorry.
He'll remember the old Sunday night request concert radio programs. I'm sure he listened to them when he was stationed in Berlin. And by the way, that call made tonight's program just worth it. I'll tell you what, but I'm going to be playing.
Well, we've got two more callers, so let's go ahead and
I'm going to be playing those request concert radio programs. I've been able to get several recordings of several hours, and I'll be playing those on my website for people like Wilhelm who remembered those back on Sunday evenings during the war.
Yeah, okay, very good, very good. Well, let's see who our next caller is. Is he ready, or she?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Hadding in Florida.
Well, hi.
I know a little bit about this. If anybody wants to get a sample of some of the lively stuff that was in some German films, you can find some clips of Marika Ruck on YouTube, R-O-K-K. Just search for that, and you'll find some rather interesting clips. I want to ask you, though, well, I'll stay on that for a second. Marika Ruck was Hungarian, and she had quite a career in the Third Reich. She was married to director George Jacobi, and there was also an actress, Lida Barová, who was Czech, who was also Goebbels' mistress. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could comment on the extent of people of foreign origin participating in the German film industry during the Third Reich.
That is an outstanding question. Also, Lida Barová, and we all know, since she was a Czech actress too, we all know her claim to fame was. She actually had a relationship with Dr. Goebbels that actually brought the intervention of Adolf Hitler. There was also one of the there was many. The short answer, Mr. Hattie, is the German film industry was not by no means 100% German. As a matter of fact, there were and the name escapes me now. It's been a long day, and I should know it because I listened to her music. Swedish actress and singer, right off the top. I can't remember right off the top of my head, but she was very famous, and she did quite well in the German film industry. Except she got crosswise with Dr. Goebbels because she insisted on being paid in Swedish currency. But Great. There was Czech actors and actresses. There was a number of Swedish actors and actresses. German, of course. It was predominantly German, but it was by no means exclusive. And there was a number of Hungarian, and there were, if I remember correctly, a few Romanian, as well. But by far I just can't remember right offhand, the name escapes me. She was a famous singer, and she by far, she was a Swedish actress. She had probably the best career of any non-German in the German film industry.
She's an opera singer. An opera singer?
No. She's a big husky brunette. I can picture her, but I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I'm having the same. Like I say, it's been a long day. I want to say Layla Anderson, but it was not Layla Anderson. It was her contemporary.
No.
They were both equally popular during the Third Reich period, and I'm having a hard time recalling her name, and I'm ashamed of that.
That's all right.
All right, I have another question, which is, what do you know about censorship policies under the Weimar period? Because I was just reading an essay by Alfred Rosenberg in which he talks of a film about Martin Luther being banned under the Weimar government.
Well, the Weimar, we talked about that earlier in the show. The Weimar film policy was repealed in 1934 and replaced by the Reich film policy. But the Weimar film policy was essentially anything goes under it. Now the film that you were talking about was the.
Yeah, well, this one film was banned apparently.
Under the new Reich film policy, they adopted some four or five primary criteria, and one of them was a film could not offend church sensitivities, or I can't remember the exact verbatim from the act. I wrote it down.
But we covered that earlier, yes. Right? But he's asking about some censorship under the Weimar.
There was.
I'm sure there was, but what it was.
I'm sure that it was, and remember, it was a film that was based on the Jews and their lies. You're familiar with the book that Martin Luther wrote late in his life called The Jews and Their Lies? There was an independent film adaptation made during the Weimar period that was blocked. But I'm not sure that it was blocked under the Weimar Act. Rosenberg made great, and I think you're reading that under one of his books, The Political Essays of Alfred Rosenberg.
I'm just reading Deutschland Zukunft, die nationalsozialistische Bewegung.
He made great political hay on that, on the fact that they blocked that film, but I'm not sure that it was blocked under the actual Weimar Film Act. I think it was blocked through court action. But don't hold me to that, because bear in mind, this is during the 20s, and there was a lot of political activity going on, but I'm not sure that it was blocked actually using the Weimar Film Act. I think it was blocked.
Yeah, he said that the ministry blocked it.
I think the Justice Ministry blocked it actually, and the film industry, the Film Act was administered under Weimar under the Interior Ministry. But again, I'm not going to say that I'm completely correct there. Because the Weimar Film Act allowed a lot of the first vestiges of what we see in the U.S. film act, a lot of perversion, a lot of stuff that we really don't want to see anymore.
Right. And I want to ask you this: what about the continuity from the Weimar period through into the Third Reich in film entertainment? Because I know that a lot of performers that had been, and directors and so forth, that had been in the Weimar period, continued in the Third Reich. Georg Jacobi, you know, was still had gotten his start under the Weimar period. Supposedly Hitler wanted Fritz Lang to work for him.
Yeah, well, people like Fritz Lang, they bailed out by 1934.
Right.
They were gone for obvious reasons because there was a concerted policy that there would no longer be any Jewish influence on German cultural life. So between the Reich Film Act that replaced the Weimar Film Act, and then of course the Nuremberg Decrees, people like Fritz Lang were gone. But a lot of the German film actors, you know, they had been actors prior, but they were Germans and they continued to act. And Jannings is a prime example. He had acted prior to 33.
I was wondering about the continuity, also in terms of the content of films, because when you look at some of these Marika Ruck films, it looks very, I mean, it looks like something. Some of the scenes look, some of the musical numbers look almost like something out of the film Cabaret. You know what I mean?
Absolutely right. Like La Habra is another one. Well, bear in mind, music. The music was a whole different type of, in the musical. That was entirely a whole different monster. And like I said earlier in the broadcast, there was a chamber of music, a chamber of film, and there's a chamber of arts and such. And
well, I'm talking about choreography and so forth. Like you have women dressed up in what looks like men's clothes in these films from the Third Reich. You don't see men in women's clothes, but you see women in men's clothes.
Well, sure, but that's not there was an assumption that the Third Reich was very ultra conservative and prudish.
Wait, we only have a few more seconds before the break.
Okay, well,
some of those musicals that you're talking about were widely produced and widely endorsed by the propaganda ministry under Goebbels.
Yeah, well, I think they tolerated. I think they.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Protests that kicked off in New York 3 weeks ago have now grown into a nationwide rally engulfing a growing number of U.S. cities every day. Demonstrators inspired by the Arab Spring demand an end to social inequality and corporate greed. And as their calls for a revolution get louder, the authorities and media are finding them harder to ignore. RT's Marina Portnaya reports.
The collective voices of American dissent has manifested into a movement impossible to ignore. Occupy Wall Street began in the world's financial capital, but this week, protests have blazed through dozens of cities nationwide. In the Big Apple, up to 15,000 Americans flooded Lower Manhattan. Labor unions, transport workers, teachers, nurses, and U.S. veterans standing shoulder to shoulder with young activists, spearheading a fight against U.S. wealth inequality and corporate greed.
Young people right now have no hope in our society. And I just want to see a fairer and more just society for the young people coming up and all of the Americans that right now are suffering through these hard economic times.
This seems pretty revolutionary to me. And the spirit of revolution is here, and so I need to be a part of it.
Once you are not afraid to be arrested anymore, the whole entire control of the police state disappears. And when that happens, there are incredible possibilities that are open to us. And suddenly you can imagine a different world, and you believe you can be an agent of change.
The Occupy movement has gained such momentum, even the president who promised change was forced to address the issue.
I think people are frustrated, and you know the protesters are giving voice to a more broad-based frustration about how our financial system works. The American people understand that not everybody's been following the rules. That Wall Street is an example of that. These days, a lot of folks who are doing the right thing aren't rewarded. And a lot of folks who aren't doing the right thing are rewarded.
While the U.S. has encouraged and supported democratic uprisings in the Arab world, the same events playing out at home have been met with batons, pepper spray, and the arrests of nearly 800 peaceful protesters on the Brooklyn Bridge, a scene that reminded some of Egypt's Tahrir Square.
We can follow the lead of our brothers and sisters all over the world in the Arab Spring in Greece, in Spain. We can see that it did send a powerful message. Ordinary people are not going to stand for corporate greed anymore, and that we're getting up and we're doing something about it.
3 weeks into the anti-Wall Street demonstrations, the New York City Police Department has pumped $2 million into overtime pay, funds some critics say are being used to repress freedom. 2 miles from the chaos.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is our last half hour for tonight, and my guest is Rodney Martin. We're talking about culture and, in particular, films in the Third Reich. We had a couple of other callers, but they dropped. You know, we don't have the best call-in system here. I'm going to say it right on the air. Our callers call in, and when they don't get on, they tend to hang up. So I think there's something that's not quite too good for them when they're waiting. They're not sure they're going to get on or something. So I do encourage anybody to call and ask a question of our guest, 855-477-2283. And in the meantime, Rodney, you thought of the name of that actress that Hadding was wanting to know.
Yes. Yeah, Mr. Hadding, it was Zara Leander. She was from Sweden, and she had a stellar career in German film up until about 1943. And we said her claim to fame, low was that she was a very shrewd negotiator, and she demanded to be paid in Swedish currency rather than Reichsmarks. And that was much to the consternation of Dr. Goebbels. And then, of course, there was real quickly, Carolyn, there was continuity in some of the musical films that Hadding was talking about, because they were immensely popular with the German populace. But they were nothing like some of the stuff that was put out during the Weimar years. And again, the film agency that was appointed in 1934, they would establish ratings. And I remember talking to one.
Rodney, we have a caller. We have a caller, sure. And maybe we should take the caller before we lose the caller. All right. Hello, are you there, caller?
Yeah, Carolyn, this is Steve from California.
Hello, Steve. Nice to talk to you.
How you doing? I do have one question. Mr. Martin, I guess, Rodney, or
yes.
Mr. Martin. Now, how long have you been at this, doing this? Because it would seem to me that it would be like almost like a lifetime to kind of like go through all this stuff.
Well, not necessarily a lifetime, but since my, university days, film has always been, and culture has been something that's been really important to me. And the films particularly, and films have always, and culture has always been something that is, a foundation of any, we talked about this earlier, of any nation or empire or such. And that's what normally is what a nation or empire leaves behind. And so if you want to look at what everyday life was like, to me, that's what you study. That's what you look at.
Yeah. I've kind of like, over the last 5 or 6 years, I've had to like, kind of throw out everything I was taught and trying to relearn, what history actually was. And over the last couple of years, it's been about Germany and the World War II period. So, and actually during the first hour, I was just kind of, doing a little bit of search, and I had found that, I guess, somebody had done a German film festival at the University of California at Los Angeles in 1995, and this person that attended was quite surprised to find out that everything he was told or grew up knowing about Germany and the Third Reich just wasn't so. And that's kind of like where I'm at, over these last couple of years. And it's just, I can really,
Is it liberating? Does it feel liberating, Steve?
But you still have those people out there that swear up and down that, and a lot of them are in the alternative media that are guilty of, the Nazi this, Nazi that. And they still want to hang on to that. Well, okay, yeah, the Holocaust didn't happen. Like they said it did, but yet, Hitler was still a bad guy. So.
Well, that's why I think the approach that Rodney is taking with culture and with films, and something that he's interested in, and he's got this huge collection of films, and he wants to share it with people. And this is one way, like you said about that fellow at the university, that festival he went to. This can really open people's eyes probably faster and better than continuing to argue over these points about, you know, what did Hitler do, what didn't he do, and so on and so forth.
Well, I commend your host, and I commend you, Carolyn. This is actually a great show. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling, Steve.
All right. You guys have a good evening.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rodney, I've got that. That's nice. Steve is really learning a lot and spreading it around. I've got a quote here I want to ask you about that. Well, that refers to the religion aspect, and I thought it was very good. This is written by Robert Schultz in 1938, and he was either an artist or an art critic or art knowledgeable. So, and he wrote, "For the National Socialists, questions of style or form did not exist. All artistic problems were metaphysical ones. Richard Wagner's dictum that art is the presentation of religion in a lively form." I had never heard that Richard Wagner proposed that art is presentation of religion in a lively form, was fully subscribed to by the ideologists of the regime. The desire of the Germans to create always grew from the two roots: a strong sensuous feeling for nature is the one, and a deep metaphysical longing would be the second one. And he continues to say, the capacity of the Germans to make the divine visible in nature and to illuminate the sensuous with spiritual values fulfills Wagner's demands for art to become religion. Now, he was talking about painting. This was all about painting on this page. And you can see that more in painting than in films, of course, which is a totally different medium and purpose to it. But I wondered what you thought. I think this idea that the spiritual is so inherent in the German soul, in the German character. And that's why it's so opposite to this Judaic culture that they're always imposing wherever they can.
Well, the spiritual side is something that they had worked very hard since 1945 to try to say doesn't equate to anything German, which is absolutely fundamentally false and absolutely wrong. And by the way, there's another quote that's attributed between Hitler and Wagner. You know, one cannot understand National Socialism unless they understand Wagner. You know, I love that quote. I love that quote. But you're absolutely right. And again, the art, and I think I told you this by email, I recently acquired an original, and it's one of my treasures, catalog from 1940 exhibit of the House of German Art. And they used to have, they'd have an exhibit or they'd update the exhibit every year and everybody would go. And this has actually the existing pieces and then, of course, the new exhibits that were placed into the art, into the exhibit, the permanent collection of the House of German Art in Munich, which was, I think it was the last building that was designed and done by Paul Ludwig Troost. And I think it was actually finished by his widow. But anyway, looking at this catalog of exhibits, Carolyn, you see that quote in these exhibits. You see the spiritual in the exhibits. And what's interesting is, like the films that we talked about, the art was all gobbled up after the war and put in storehouses or destroyed. And I think as late as 2005, there were 4,000 pieces of art still locked up by the United States government that had yet to be repatriated to the German government.
And then when the Germans get it, what are they going to do? They're going to lock it up
themselves. Destroy it. Well, that's
the
thing.
Probably they will.
I think that is because you can go and get a pass to the National Archives. I've seen the German art exhibit. I've actually have seen some of the pieces that are in the National Archives in Washington, D.C. that have been locked up since the end of the war. But, the fact that they've gone out of their way, the Jewish lobby and the anti-National Socialist lobby in perpetuating this anti-German narrative, and I love that statement, this anti-German narrative that Germans are not spiritual or they weren't spiritual, and that the only good German is the new neuter German of 2000, mm-hmm. which is, which is false. The Germany in 1933, 1945, that was a nation that became self-sufficient. They were a folkish, a people's society. They were a society. There was a vast rebirth in the arts, in music, in film that has not happened probably in 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, when was the last time that that you can think of in modern times where a nation has been bankrupt, broken, destitute, and that in 36 months has experienced both an economic and a cultural, and we'll go ahead, and a military rebirth and become a world power on all three,
That shows the power of those ideas of the particular nationalist ideas that fit the Germans that were promoted at that time. And it was for the German people. It wasn't meant to be for the whole world.
There was
a tremendous respect for others in National Socialist Germany that other people would create their own special way of life, their special
When people ask me why did the Germans fight to the bitter end in April and May of 45, it's because they had something to fight for. They were fighting for something bigger than themselves. Sure, I'm sure they knew what the end result was going to be in the end of April of 45, but they kept fighting because they were fighting for something bigger than themselves. They had something to fight for. That is, there's a big difference. When I keep you hear that, that big propaganda today, Saddam Hussein is the next Hitler and all of this. I mean, they do that on purpose. It is so patently false and so laughable. No other nation has fought and defended its society in the throes, the way that Germany did at the end of 45. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's remarkable. But I gotta go back.
Well, they knew what they were they knew what they were facing. How they were going to be treated because they had already been through it after World War One, and now it's going to be worse.
Yeah, it was going to be worse.
So they did.
I go back to fundamentally between 1933 and 1936. 36 months, you had a nation that became economically self-sufficient and became a world power both culturally, economically, and militarily. That just hasn't happened. It hasn't happened before or since in that length of time. And the cultural rebirth, you want to know what the truth was? It wasn't done by, robbing and looting other nations. I mean, the war didn't start in earnest until 1940, really. Poland was a mere skirmish. The war really didn't start. So, I mean, Germany didn't, a lot of people say, Germany's great success was because it stole everything during the war. Wrong. The war didn't start in earnest until 40. This is a remarkable society to study instead of demonize. It's a remarkable society and culture to learn from. And I think we have our work cut out for us to continue to, use the culture and teach people and show the people. You want to know what life is like? Look at what they left us behind. They left us some buildings. There's still some buildings that the current German government hasn't torn down and desecrated yet. But there is still a significant amount of cultural culture that they've left us that we can study.
Here's another quote I'd like to give about this. Again, is about painting, but it brings up some interesting ideas. It says, I don't know who this came from. But it says the demand for naturalness, vitality, and sensualism found its visual counterpart in the presentation of the naked body. Here too, now this they were talking about the nudes done during the during National Socialist period, the painters. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say that in the arts, the architecture really blossomed, and there was great architecture being done. There was great sculpture being done. There were mm-hmm. genius sculptors working, but in the field of painting, it never really reached those levels. And even Hitler, who really supported the painters and held exhibitions that were, you know, state exhibitions and so on, and sponsored these painters. And he himself bought paintings right and left. I mean, he paid for them. You know, he had money from his from royalties from his book and so on. And he spent it on in Germany for a lot of it in the arts. And he bought a lot of paintings and in order to encourage. But he said that he was kind of disappointed that, that there was no really great painters that rose up during that time. One of the best known is Adolf Ziegler. But this, again, getting back to this quote that I was going to read about painting. So so they did have nudes, and this person is saying that it was because of they occurred in antiquity, the Renaissance, and the old masters that provided the models for this idea of painting nudes. The nudes of Titian, Tintoretto, Michelangelo, Rubens, and Rembrandt were one thing. But he said the nudes of the Impressionists, and Hitler did not care for the for Impressionism, even. Nudes of the Impressionists, especially Edouard Manet's Olympia, if people are familiar with that, it's a famous realistic nude, were rejected as a mere experience of the eye, the body painted for its own sake, the carrier of colors. But goes on to say, but not the expression of a moral, sociological, and religious attitude which determined the nudes of the Third Reich. The presentation of the devil woman, the prostitute, as modern artists often depicted her, was not only unthinkable, but was considered an insult to German womanhood. If a man was shown as the dominator of nature, woman was represented as nature herself. She was the beauty of nature or the playfulness of nature, and of course was as fertile as nature. She was, well, I won't finish that. So that, you know, that is a distinction, again, that's being made about the art of the Third Reich rather than being, well, some kind of I don't know. Mostly it's made fun of as being third rate, which it definitely is.
Let me give you a comment on that. I think art, painting art, is always catching up. I think it's always a little bit behind, takes a little while to catch up. And I think there's an example. Art that's available that you can get that hasn't been confiscated, that's locked away, that was produced during the Third Reich period, goes for great prices on the market today. And I think that's a testament to the artwork that was done during the Third Reich period. But there was a larger emphasis, and I think we need to understand that there was a larger emphasis on sculpture and on architecture, and a lot of the sculptures were destroyed. They were destroyed. There's very few sculptures left, and what few are left, and actually every once in a while they do come up for sale, they go for tremendously high prices. So I think that's a testament in and of itself, Carolyn. And, of course, we know, I mean, I think I'm obviously a biased source. I think we know that the film and the music was just outstanding. And then finally, real quickly, before we run out of time, there's one of the biggest lies that had been perpetrated was that, you know, Hitler stole all of his furnishings, all of his art, all of his books and such. And that is categorically false.
Yes,
he
it
bought,
is.
He purchased his items. As a matter of fact, not too terribly long ago, a copy of his insurance policy, he took out an extra insurance policy on his artwork and on his books, and he had a huge library, personal library,
yes.
And actually he had to provide almost proof of purchase for the items that he had bought each time he added them to his insurance policy. And there was an interesting little story that his one of the housekeepers who recently passed away told that Eva Braun had asked him about some statue someplace or statuette that she wanted because she spent a lot of time at the Berghof. And he said, well, I can't get that for you. That's state property. I mean, it's just it's incredible the lies that are told about that person, considering his upbringing and everything that all of his staff has said about him, who worked with him and continued to remain loyal up until, you know, very recently in their 80s and 90s. But the art, Carolyn, I think art is always a little bit behind music and of course what we could call cinema and film. I think the proof is that what art pieces are available and that are sold from the Third Reich go for huge prices. There is a, and of course, people just don't go around bragging about it because they'll get, you know, what'll happen to them. I have reproduction of a lot that I've had, really, and it looks very professional in my study, and people have been in my home and bragged about that beautiful piece of artwork, and when I told them it's from the Third Reich, they about pass out.
Okay, listeners, if you want to call, you can still call in at 855-477-2283 if you'd like to make a comment or have a question. Do you have any final things that you can tell us, or anything, any final thoughts, Rodney, about the film industry, or about what your plans are, or how we, well, how people can see some of these films? How can we see some of these films?
Okay, first watch my website. I'll be having some announcements on there probably within the next 30 days, and then two. There are, if you get a chance to buy any of these films, do buy them, because there is an incredible amount of political and legal pressure being put on the producers of these films that are still producing them for commercial sale by the German government to cease. There are a few firms out there that they do that do sell them. You can just Google a title or Google Third Reich films. Some websites still do sell them. If you can buy them and you do have an affinity for them, get them, because I suspect there's going to be more pressure brought to bear to not sell them. I mean, I've seen a reduction in titles that are available.
Well, are there quite a lot of titles available? I've never looked for them, actually. So if we
there has been, but I've seen a reduction. I've actually seen a reduction of what was available, Carolyn, just in the last 5 years. 5 years ago, I thought, there was a lot available, but then.
Well, if you have them, you could make copies and you could go into business yourself selling CDs. Yeah.
I'd like to be able to put something together to screen them and make them available for the public domain.
Yeah, but you can only go to so many places. And you can't reach that many people. But if you sold CDs, if you made copies of these, would you get in trouble?
If there's no copyright on them. Not if there's no copyright. And most of these, there's no copyright. The copyrights were, especially the ones that were released by the U.S. back in the 60s. So, the only, I wouldn't know. It's something I have to look at.
I think that would be great. You could sell them at your film festivals. And also on your website, and then the more people that would have copies of them, that the better that would be. Actually, doesn't mean that we still wouldn't want to go to see them at a festival, I guess. But well, I know I won't be going to any festivals in California.
I might have one in Texas. So,
well, that would be good.
I've got an email from folks in Houston that desperately wants to have one there. So,
okay.
But I haven't gotten. It's just a matter of logistics, and I do have some things I got to work out. But initially, I want to get at least a couple done. But I want to mix them together where there's some artwork and some music, and I want to get it perfected, before. Mm-hmm. Done right, but and I think it's something that'd be well received by but it's something that the serious scholar would really enjoy. It's not something that it's not like going to the walk-in theater down on Main Street. It's something somebody comes to blur to learn and absorb and see what life is like and have a discussion and enjoy the company of like-minded folks that want to learn this stuff.
We can't be too fussy about it, or we won't
reach
enough people.
Oh no, we make it fun, of course. And that's another thing in my closing, Carolyn, is there's a tremendous amount of comedy in these films as well. You watch these films,
that's true,
and the comedy you see when you watch these various films, and the comedy you see in this, they are not by any means truths in these films at all. It's just amazing. You'll see clips of everyday life, and they're doing some sets, some satirical offshoots of some everyday life events in these films, and it's like, wow, you can just envision that happening, and it happening now. I mean, it's just...
Do they all have subtitles? Do they all have subtitles?
Some of them, yeah. Some of them do, and that's where some of the ones I have are all German, and I'm actually contracting, looking to contract with some folks to actually subtitle them and make sure they're subtitled correctly and accurately.
Okay. All right. Well, Rodney, we are just about over, so I want to thank you very much for being on the program. It's been really enlightening. And your website, again, is wbfoundations.org. And people can email you there and ask for all the questions they want.
Thank you again, Carol.
You're welcome. And we'll do it again. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.